This episode is brought to you by Progressive, home of the Name Your Price tool. You say how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. It's easy to start a quote. Visit progressive.com to get started. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Hello and welcome to This Day in Esoteric Political History from Radiotopia. My name is Jody Avergan. This day, November 15th, 2011, New York City begins to clear out the Occupy Wall Street encampment at Zuccotti Park in Lower Manhattan. At about 1 a.m., police handed out notices from the park's owner, Brookfield Office Properties, with the city backing up the move, basically stating that the park had to be cleared because it had become unsanitary and hazardous. Protesters had occupied the park for almost 2 months at this point, with up to 200 people living there semi-permanently and at times up to 1,000 or so gathered in the small park. Protesters were told that they could return, but they couldn't bring back sleeping bags, tarps, or tents. So this was really the end of the permanent encampment at Zuccotti Park. So this is our chance to talk about both that encampment itself as a physical space, but also the larger movement as a political force in our time. And here to do that, as always, is Nicole Hemmer of Columbia. Hello, Nikki, and happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Jody.
Yeah. And I say that because I will point out that we are doing a Sunday show here, and we've mentioned this a few times, but we're going to keep going with these Sunday shows, at least for the foreseeable future. We just like doing three a week. We find that there's plenty to talk about. And we're having fun. But if anyone has any thoughts about the number of shows per week or the Sunday shows or other things, just feel free to email us. But we're kind of figuring it out as we go. Not unlike the beginning of the Occupy movement.
I was about to say a little bit of crowdsourcing, a little bit of coming to consensus about what we're doing here.
Exactly, a little human microphone. we'll talk a lot about like some of those little moments within the encampment itself. But then obviously the larger movement. And I will just say, you know, if you want to sort of get a quick sense of what the movement became, just that simple shift from Occupy Wall Street to just now the shorthand of Occupy says so much, right? It did start as this physical encampment on Wall Street or right near Wall Street. And let's start there before we get to this larger movement. So geographically, Zuccotti Park is in Lower Manhattan. It is near the World Trade Center. It is near Wall Street itself. Nikki, have you been down there? Have you seen Zuccotti Park itself?
I have seen Zuccotti Park, just kind of rambling around that part of Manhattan. Although I have to say, I wasn't actually in New York at the time. I was living down in Sydney, and there were Occupy encampments in Sydney as well. So we'll talk about later how this is a global phenomenon, but
for sure,
heart of Manhattan is where it started.
Yeah, and I was in New York, and I was working at WNYC Radio at the time, very much covering it, and I went down there a fair amount and saw it. You know, the first thing I'll say is, New York, one of the few places where you get to call something that looks like that a park, right? This is a park by New York City. Look, we have parks. We have actual parks with green, but there is very little green there. It is mostly concrete, sort of black slab concrete with some little trees and stuff. But it's like a plaza, but it's called a park. We have to take what we can here in New York City.
And notably, a privately owned plaza. It's the kind of thing that the people who build those very tall buildings downtown, they have to have. They have to have some sort of open space. But it obviously is an important part of the story that it is privately owned.
Yes. And also, you know, there's all in New York, a lot of these privately owned public spaces, what's known as POPs. And that's a very interesting story in and of itself about how the city has, as you said, cut deals and created this space. But it does then manifest itself in who gets to then talk about this encampment and who gets to kick people out at certain points and what's negotiated around it. But anyway, let's go to the kind of roots of how a group of people ended up at Zuccotti Park building encampments. What is your sense of where exactly this started and then how it moved to a physical encampment?
Sure. So it actually comes out of the publication Adbusters. I don't know if people remember this, but it was a Canadian publication. It was led by Callie Lassen, and it had this strong anti-consumerist bent. And after the massive collapse of the global economy that was largely driven by the financial industry, there had been this kind of delayed protest, right? We'd seen the Tea Party protest, but any kind of like left-wing protest against what had happened in the financial industry hadn't really emerged. And it's actually inspired in some ways by what was happening overseas, by the early stirrings of the Arab Spring, and this idea that, well, if people over there can begin to build a revolution, maybe we should start building a revolution here. And Occupy Wall Street comes out of that sense that it was time for change.
Yeah. And, you know, the Arab Spring context is really important. But also your mention of Adbusters is really important, because that then brings us, I think, back even further into a sort of long simmering anti-globalization, anti-free trade movement. And so you can then see the ties back to the World Trade Organization protests mm-hmm. in the late 90s, moving into the 2000s. So there are those roots there. And then the Arab Spring. And then, of course, the financial crisis. And I think that's all the things that sort of come flowing together. One interesting tidbit in reading up about this is that it did sort of coalesce into this, hey, let's have a physical encampment a la Tahrir Square. Let's do it in New York. And it came together, you know, as a modern movements do, online. And one of the sort of key moments in all of this, at least according to a New Yorker piece that sort of traces the roots of the organizing here, was literally picking a URL and saying, this is what we're going to be. And so, you know, apparently the final three URL choices were OccupyWallStreet.org, KampataWallStreet.org, and TakeWallStreet.org. And the early organizers decided, okay, well, we'll OccupyWallStreet.org sounds a little better. Maybe it was slightly cheaper or something. But, you know, it's just a nice little tidbit of like, that's how they landed on the name, and that's how they landed on the kind of thing that would become the hallmark for the whole movement.
Pick your hashtags wisely.
Exactly. Yeah. And let's talk about the internet side of this, too, because I also remember a big part of this was this phrase that was very internet powered, which is we are the 99%. And this, I think, Occupy Wall Street and the movement at Occupy Wall Street was the first time that got really put into the bloodstream, the 99% versus the 1%. And a lot of it was Tumblr inspired, Tumblr very big in 2011, but there were tons of people taking photos down at Occupy Wall Street, and then people taking photos at home, celebrities taking photos, but picking up this mantra of we are the 99%, really starting to find language to talk about wealth inequality in this country.
And it gets into the political bloodstream pretty quickly, because it starts to get wrapped up into the 2012 election, even though a lot of these protests were just as much against the Obama administration as they were against Wall Street, you know, concerns that the administration hadn't prosecuted individuals for the financial crisis. Because it was Barack Obama running against Mitt Romney, that crystallization of inequality is a key theme of the 2012 election, I think. Even though Obama himself didn't exactly embrace Occupy Wall Street, that undercurrent of a conversation and protest about inequality was certainly the water in mm-hmm. which everyone was swimming in 2012.
Yeah. And I don't think it's a coincidence that this takes place in Michael Bloomberg's New York, right? We have very sort of tangible understanding of the role of billionaires.
Yes.
And so I think, you know, that was certainly part of it as well. But what is we'll get back to some of the details of the park itself, but in this larger political context, I'm curious, since you work on the Obama era and that's your latest project, I mean, what is your sense of how the Obama administration saw Occupy from within?
So I don't think that they spent a whole lot of time talking about it. And, you know, as I go deeper and deeper into research about the administration, I might stumble across some contradictory information. But, you know, there were voices like Elizabeth Warren that were starting to come up through the Obama administration. But by and large, there was a lot of attention on the Tea Party and beating back the threat of the Tea Party. And I think a sense that there was something insubstantial about Occupy Wall Street. It had very dismissive treatment in the media, as you know, oh, they don't stand for anything, they don't believe in anything, what is this all about? And I think there was a little bit of that reflected in the Obama administration as well, that this isn't something that we have to directly confront.
Yeah. Well, that dismissal of Occupy as, well, what are you actually standing for? What are your demands, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is such a consistent theme and such a consistent way to diminish protest movements. And we're seeing it even now with the protests around George Floyd. You know, it's like, or, you know, I remember even like when the NBA this year, the players walked off and immediately everyone was saying, okay, well, but now what next? And sure, that's a reasonable question, but like sometimes just an act of protest is, it can be an end in and of itself, and a sort of expression of rage can be an end in and of itself. And so I think you see that diminishment happen with Occupy as well.
Well, and even when there are very clear demands, and right. I think as there have been in many of the police brutality protests, and as there were with Occupy Wall Street. I mean, yes. I know that there was some complaint about them not being clear enough, but there were clear demands mm-hmm. of the things that they wanted. But that wasn't the narrative that broke through. It wasn't the story that people wanted to tell about Occupy Wall Street. So it wasn't the story that was told.
Yeah. I mean, talk about a sort of, if you want to measure a movement success, you know, putting a big idea into the bloodstream of just wealth inequality and then some very specific things. I think, for instance, the minimum wage conversation and the emergence of $15 minimum wage mm-hmm. is a very tangible goal. You know, that strikes me as enough for a movement to call it successful and important and worth thinking about.
And it's a movement that took time to sort of seed the political earth. And it was being compared so much to the Tea Party. Yeah. The Tea Party was taking advantage of pre-existing infrastructures within the Republican Party and within the conservative movement. It was amplified within a conservative media that gave it a sense of not just like this idea that it was a grassroots movement, but also that it was well organized. It had clear things that it wanted. And against that, Occupy was always seen as less substantial, less organized, less focused on electoral politics. But what yeah. was being missed was that Occupy was a real grassroots movement, and that it would sort of seed the Democratic Party for what we've seen in 2016 and 2020, which is a real renewed emphasis on economic policies to address inequality.
Right. And, you know, obviously we haven't said Bernie Sanders' name yet, but clearly that's the line that we're drawing here into the rise of Bernie Sanders and his role in modern
Absolutely.
Politics. But there is also something with Occupy in terms of the tactics of modern protest that I want to talk about a little bit. And we've mentioned this on the show before, but, you know, just the remarkable nature of modern protest as being so diffuse, happening in so many places at different times. And it is sort of interesting to think about a movement that is like started as something about specific occupation of a geographical space, but then at the same time feels all over the world and all over the country, happening in many different places at once. And I think it's important to remember, like, that was what very quickly was happening. I mean, there were little Occupies popping up everywhere. And I guess you saw one in Australia.
Yeah, I saw it in Sydney. When I moved back to the US, I saw the sort of permanent encampments on like K Street in DC. So even though the Zuccotti Park encampment was done away with in fairly short order, I think after about 40 days or so, these other encampments and the slogans and the ideas had been seeded across the country. They'd been seeded across the world. And in some ways, you know, Jody, there's a real similarity between Occupy and a lot of the protests of the 1960s. A lot of those were taking place as local takeovers of spaces. They were often local groups, but because they were amplified in the media and amplified through organizations and networks, they would inspire similar protests and similar movements, not just in the US, but around the world as well. And that same kind of criticisms that were being put on Occupy were the same kinds of criticisms that were put on these 60s protests as well.
Right. Yeah. Though I do think it is interesting that Occupy never had that moment like other protests that we've talked about, like the Million Man March, or like mm-hmm. there were not these sort of there were little like sort of pockets of relatively big protests. Like, even there were moments at Union Square where there would be 10,000 people or so. But it was, again, it was not this protest movement that was focused on, we need to gather millions of people in one place on one day to show force, because it knew that it, as you said, could capture media attention and perhaps even tell a more compelling story with this sort of diffuse nature of the protest. And that like also, you know, just to think about some of the elements of the protest itself, that also trickled down to the way it was actually organized. Obviously, the internet and the rise of mobile had a huge impact in the way that this was organized. But then people, you might remember, this is where we first started to hear about the human microphone. I guess that's an organizing tactic that goes back a while. But, you know, the human microphone, where people were not speaking through amplification because amplification was not allowed at some of these sites. And so people were echoing what speakers had to say, the idea that anyone could really speak at any given moment. Celebrities were coming down into Zuccotti Park. I was looking at a slideshow of celebrities who were showing up at Zuccotti Park. Kanye was there, Russell Simmons, Susan Sarandon, you know. But, you know, it really was this, yeah, I guess it did kind of feel very 60s in that sense of like just this like this happening.
And also don't forget that Third Eye Blind creates a song that's for the Occupy movement. It's called If There Ever Was a Time. And when I used to teach about this in my my undergrad classes, I would play this song, and I started playing it again just to prepare for this episode. And it is an earworm and just sticks in your head. Well, like, you know how all Third Eye Blind songs kind of sound.
Yes,
exactly
they write some very good, but they do know how to write songs that get stuck in your head. I just didn't realize they had written songs past 2004 or whatever. But
they snuck one more in 2011 that becomes one of the anthems.
So you want to say a little bit more about kind of the legacy here? I mean, obviously we talk about Bernie Sanders, and I remember just even like a year later, do you remember that book, Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty?
Thomas Piketty,
right. Yeah. And I mean, you know, the fact that this was like an academic treatise about income inequality based around one particular measure, but it became like a New York Times bestseller. Like, I just think it's really important to remember how much this conversation on income inequality was sort of new at that time, and then how quickly it just became part of the lingua franca of talking about modern America.
And the way that people devoured that book. I mean, I had a student who...
They devoured the first three pages of that
book. Well, fair enough, and devoured the argument. But I did have a student who, just this very earnest student at Miami, who read the whole thing cover to cover because he really wanted to understand what was going on. I mean, it's the same sort of, if not the Occupy itself, but that sentiment was fueling the fight for 15. It was fueling Bernie Sanders. It was fueling the rise of Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah.
That many of the faces we now associate with the core of the Democratic Party in a lot of ways are reflecting the sentiments of this movement that at the time was dismissed as a nothing burger, as just... ephemeral. And it's been so interesting to see the way that it did kind of fracture, but that fracturing was planting a diverse range of seeds that would sort of sprout over the coming years.
I did not expect to be talking about Thomas Piketty this much, but I just remembered one little tidbit, which I'm pretty sure this is right, but someone did an analysis of, so like when you read a book on a Kindle, you can add notes and bookmarks, right? And that goes to a server and you can sort of use that as a data set about where the notes and bookmarks are. And someone did an analysis and noticed that like 95% of the bookmarks and notes and highlights in Thomas Piketty's Capital were in the first like five pages. And it was just like this great little moment of data analysis and data visualization to show that like everyone bought the book, everyone read the first five, and then they stopped. But that's what happens all the time. That's what people did with Hillbilly Elegy too. Like all these books, you know, no one actually reads them.
All of those biographies of presidents that you buy your dad for Father's Day.
Right, exactly.
Probably same stats.
Yeah. So as we start to wrap up here, I mean, I think one other thing that you can look at from Occupy Wall Street, and certainly you can do this with the history of protests in this country, but and see parallels to today, is just this relationship between protest movements and the police. And we're hooking today to this moment when the police decided and the city decided to actually move out this encampment. In the days later, there were skirmishes. About 5 or 6 days later, there was the famous incident where cops just came through and pepper sprayed people to break up the crowd. So again, I'm not trying to act like this is something new in American history or American protests, but you look at Occupy and you look at the contentious relationship between police and protesters and the way the police try and break up crowds, and you certainly see those roots. And you know, the NYPD in particular, you see those all the way through to this summer, of course.
Yeah, I think that moment where one officer in particular just sprayed copious amounts of pepper spray on a number of protesters, it becomes a meme, right? Because it's one of the first protests that's happening in this social media era, when more and more people are on social media, and one of the first American protests, I should say. And you know, there is a criticism of police brutality, but it's through the lens of a police defense of capital. And I think that it is missing in that moment that kind of racial analysis and the racist policing angle. But I think if someone were writing a history of activism in this era, they would not want to overlook the role of frustration with the police and a sense that the police were overstepping their bounds in the ways that they treated targeted protesters in Occupy.
Yeah, and the way that it was, again, being captured and the way that the internet was letting people see what was happening on the ground in a way that wasn't before. And obviously, that is a huge part of the story around police brutality, especially police killing of black men. You know, this is 2011, 2012, 2013. That's where you really start to see all these police videos come out. And it's not that police were not acting that way before. It's that there were now more cameras to see how police are behaving. So yeah, that's definitely part of the story. You can see those roots in Occupy. Okay, let's wrap up and let's switch gears a little bit and do a couple also on this days, which we haven't done in a while, but there are a couple good ones on this day. So let's see, November 15th, also on this day in 1864, Union Major William Tecumseh Sherman leaves Atlanta on his march to the sea. This is famously the brutal, fiery Sherman's March. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, he winds up in Savannah about a month later doing what he estimated was something like $100 million worth of damage. He said that about 20% of it was strategic and the rest was, look, it had been a long war and they burned and smashed a lot of stuff. They also attracted a lot of refugees, African-Americans who were fleeing enslavement.
Yeah. Yeah. My couple thoughts on this are that certainly if you travel through Georgia, you can see the legacy of that, parts of Georgia that were just burned to the ground at that time. And then I lived in Savannah for a while, and Savannans love to point out, and Savannah famously has a story that it tells about itself, that Sherman got to Savannah and said, "This place is too beautiful. I'm not going to burn it down." And, you know, maybe, I don't know how truthful that is, but that's definitely a point of pride. And people say, Savannah, you know, even Sherman on his fiery march did not touch Savannah when he got to the sea. The other thing I will mention is that this is my opportunity to say that Sherman's March, the Ross McElwee documentary, is one of my favorite films of all time. And if you haven't seen it, it's kind of only barely about William Tecumseh Sherman. But if you haven't seen it, go see Ross McElwee's documentary, Sherman's March. 1937, also on this day, November 15th, air conditioning comes to Congress. They had air conditioning in 1937 and Congress got it?
I mean, they had a little bit of air conditioning. Yeah. They had been experimenting with ways to cool down that stupid swamp that the mm-hmm. nation's capital is in for some time. It worked okay, but it was really the mid-1950s that they get strong enough air conditioning that they're willing to work through the summer. Right.
And this is my chance to point out my theory that if people were just better rested, a little more sober, and maybe not as hot, American politics would be a lot better. And so I'm glad that there is air conditioning in Congress. Anything you can do to just make people a little more comfortable and relaxed.
That's why Congress is so functional now.
Yes, exactly, because they have air conditioning. We need to lace everyone's coffee with CBD or something in order to get past this.
That's right. Just put edibles on every desk in Congress, yeah. And maybe it'll go a little better.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, we're going to leave it there. Nicole Hemmer, thanks to you as always.
Thank you, Jody.
This Day in Esoteric Political History is a proud member of the Radiotopia Network from PRX. Our producer and researcher is Jacob Feldman. Our producer is Brittany Brown. Again, I'll say the email is thisdaypod@gmail.com. You can also find us online, thisdaypod.com. You can find us on social @thisdaypod. So get in touch if you have any questions or comments about the show. Keep leaving ratings and reviews. My name is Jody Avergan. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Whatever you do, don't despair, because this is the hard part. You're in the hard part right now.
Whatever you do, don't despair, because this is the hard part. You're in the hard part right now.
But everyone will remember.
Everyone will remember.
3 months from now.
3 months from now.
6 months from now.
6 months from now.
100 years from now.
100 years from now.
That you came down to this plaza.
That you came down to this plaza.
And you started this movement.
And you started this movement.
Radiotopia.